We put a lot of trust in science, right, to
Yeah.
explain our world. But what happens when the way science gets done, well, when it comes under scrutiny, where exactly is that line between, really digging into the data and maybe pushing things a bit too far?
Yeah, that's the core question.
And that's what we're tackling today. Turns out there's this surprisingly large gray area in research, actions that aren't like outright misconduct, but
Yeah.
maybe not best practice either.
Exactly. And for this deep dive, we're looking at a really insightful paper by Christian Linder and Sivash Farabash. It's called Unfolding the Black Box of Questionable Research Practices. Where's the line between acceptable and unacceptable practices? They really get into this blurry boundary.
It's so important because, like the authors say, even though we talk a lot about these questionable research practices, QRPs, they call them,
Right,
the
QRPs.
basic ethical ideas
Yeah.
behind what's okay and what's not,
Yeah.
they often aren't clearly spelled out.
No, they're often kind of vague, and that can leave researchers feeling, well, unsure. Are they doing the right thing?
Yeah, are they on solid ground? So if you've ever wondered about, how reliable scientific findings really are, or the pressures researchers face.
The pressure to publish.
Exactly. This discussion should give you some valuable perspective. We're going to try and unpack what makes a research practice questionable and look at a framework for thinking about these tricky ethical spots.
Let's do it.
Okay, so let's start unpacking this. One of the really concerning things the paper highlights is just how difficult it can be to reproduce published scientific findings.
Oh, absolutely. The numbers are, well, they're quite eye-opening in fields like psychology, biology, even medical science. Some estimates suggest only like 15 to 30% of published results can be reliably replicated.
15%. Wow.
Yeah. And the authors are careful to note the social sciences face similar challenges. So this isn't just one or two
So
fields.
for you listening, this means a big chunk of what gets published might not actually hold up later on,
Right.
which affects everything, right? From how we understand behavior to medical stuff.
Exactly. It's a serious issue. And the paper argues these QRPs, these questionable practices, are a big reason why reproducibility is often so low.
Okay, so what are these QRPs? What kind of things are we talking about?
Well, the authors pull from lots of research. They give examples like neglecting to report all the different things you measured in a study.
Right, only reporting what worked.
Sort of. Or deciding to collect more data after you've already peeked at the results.
Okay.
Then there's something called p-hacking. We'll definitely get more into that.
Okay.
Not being clear about the context, maybe manipulating results slightly, or in the worst cases, just falsifying data, making it up.
Those examples really show how things can go wrong. But the paper also makes this really crucial point. It's not all clear-cut fraud or misconduct. There's this big gray area.
That's a super important distinction. A lot of researchers working in this gray zone might genuinely think they aren't doing anything wrong.
Or they see it as trivial, basically.
Exactly. Or maybe even necessary shortcuts, you know? Just how things are done.
Yeah, like it's not that big of a deal. The authors even suggest that researchers who are, basically honest can still end up using QRPs.
Right. Especially if they're facing uncertainty, like which statistical method should I use here?
And they might lean towards the one that makes the results look better, more publishable.
It's a temptation, definitely. When you have options, the one that gives you that nice statistically significant finding can be hard to resist, even with the best initial intentions.
Okay, this is where it gets really interesting for me. The paper points out that so much of the discussion around QRPs is about identifying them. Like, what are they? How often do they happen?
Methodological focus.
Right. But it doesn't always dig into the ethical reasons why certain practices are actually problematic.
That's a key argument they make. Loads of literature on the how many and what types, but less on the underlying ethical principles. It's like having a list of don'ts without always getting a solid why.
So you know not to do it, but maybe not why it undermines the science.
Exactly. And while there are some ethical approaches, they often talk in terms of general scientific norms, not the specific nuances of this gray area. The ethical foundations often remain kind of vague or just implicit.
Just sort of assumed. And the authors argue this lack of clarity, this vagueness, it causes real problems.
It really does, because without clear ethical grounding, how does a researcher know when they're just doing legitimate exploratory analysis versus crossing a line into something harmful, something morally unjustifiable?
It sounds like we tend to talk about these things in black and white. Good research versus bad research.
Right, a binary view. But the authors argue that just doesn't capture the complexity, especially in quantitative science, where data analysis involves so many choices.
It's messy in reality.
It is, and things we've tried, like making data public, pushing for more replication studies, better statistical training they've helped, but they haven't fully solved the problem.
So the paper argues we need a more solid ethical foundation. We need to think more deeply about the why.
Yes, exactly. They stress that the moral quality of a research practice isn't simple. It depends on various norms like freedom of science, professional standards, field-specific norms, and crucially, the responsibility researchers have to anyone who relies on their published results. Think policymakers, other scientists, the public.
And just pointing to professional standards isn't enough, is it? Because those standards need interpretation.
Precisely. And it's that interpretation that needs the solid normative grounding. We need to think about the ethical principles guiding all those choices researchers make.
Okay, so to provide this grounding, the paper brings in this idea of discourse ethics. Can you break that down for us? What does that mean in this context?
Sure. Think of it like this. Discourse ethics suggests that whether a practice is acceptable should ultimately depend on whether the relevant scientific community could, through open, reasoned discussion, agree that it's a fair and appropriate way to conduct science.
So it's about collective agreement, reasoned consensus.
Exactly. It emphasizes that role of the community in defining moral norms. It's not just up to the individual researcher. It asks, would we, as a field, agree this is okay if everyone did it?
That's quite different from just looking at the statistics of QRPs.
Right. And it's also different from what they call eclecticism in ethics, where researchers might just pick and choose justifications that suit what they want to do anyway. Discourse ethics pushes for a more principled, community-based agreement.
Okay. To make this more concrete, the paper uses p-hacking as a key example. It gets a lot of attention. How do they define p-hacking?
Their working definition is pretty straightforward. Trying multiple things until you get the desired result.
The result being?
Usually that statistically significant finding, you know, getting that p-value under the magical 0.05 threshold.
Right. And this trying multiple things can look like a lot of different actions, I imagine.
Oh, yeah. The paper lists several common techniques, things like running lots of different statistical analyses on the same data set until one works. Changing the rules for data eligibility, like who gets included or excluded after seeing the data.
Tweaking the sample.
Mm-hmm. Stopping data collection early, just because you hit significance. Selectively reporting only the significant effects and ignoring the non-significant ones.
It sounds like there's a lot of flexibility after you've collected the data that can be exploited.
Exactly. They call it post-analysis flexibility. Choosing which variables to include, how to handle outliers, adding or removing covariates, even manipulating the beta set by combining groups or splitting them differently. Lots of choices.
And the harm of this, if results are packed?
Well, the big risk is that the published result might just be a statistical artifact, a fluke produced by all that trying, not a real effect.
So it looks real, but it isn't.
Potentially, yes.
No.
And this leads to a biased scientific literature. An accumulation of false positives, basically, which can really mess up theory development and any practical applications built on that faulty research.
Okay, so if it's potentially so damaging, why do researchers do it? The paper gets into the pressures, right?
Yes, absolutely. A huge factor is the publication logic of academic journals. There's often a strong bias towards publishing statistically significant results.
That significance is a gold standard idea.
Exactly. If it's not significant, it's often seen as less interesting, less impactful. So researchers feel pushed to, as the paper says, chase the significant.
And this leads to the file drawer effect.
Right. Studies with non-significant results are much less likely to get published. They end up stuck in the researcher's metaphorical file drawer.
Meaning the published literature we see isn't the full picture. It's skewed towards positive findings.
Precisely. It can create a misleading impression. The paper even mentions an estimate that maybe 95% of studies showing no effect might languish in those file drawers.
95%. That's staggering. And it's not just journal pressure, right? It's the whole academic system.
Absolutely. The publisher perish culture is real, especially for early career researchers. Publications are currency. They need them for jobs, grants, promotion. The stakes are incredibly high.
You can kind of see why someone might feel tempted to bend the rules a bit, even if they know it's not ideal.
You can understand the pressure. And the paper notes that in highly competitive fields, you might see even more of this kind of counter-normative behavior. People feel they have to do whatever it takes.
Now, the paper also weaves in academic freedom. How does that play into this? Because researchers do need freedom to explore, right?
That's a really important tension. Yes, following norms gives research legitimacy, but science also needs freedom. Many norms are implicit, and researchers need space to try new approaches, follow unexpected leads. We don't want rigid rules stifling discovery.
So it's a balance. How do they reconcile that?
Well, they argue academic freedom isn't absolute. It doesn't include the right to essentially harm the credibility of science for personal benefit.
Right.
And importantly, from a deontological perspective, focusing on the act itself, the intention, the correctness of a PACT outcome, even if it happens to be right by chance, doesn't justify the questionable practice used to get there. The intention matters.
Right. So this leads us to their proposed framework, based on discourse ethics, to help researchers navigate this gray area. What are the core questions they suggest?
Okay. It boils down to two key questions researchers should ask themselves about their practices. First, would anybody affected by my academic field have justifiable concerns regarding the rules and norms of dealing with data that are the cornerstone of my practices?
Okay. Would others have valid concerns? What's the second one?
Second, do I envisage my data analysis procedure as the norm in my academic field?
Do I think everyone should do it this way? Okay, let's unpack that. What if the answer is yes to the first? Others would have concerns and no to the second. I don't think this should be the norm.
According to the authors, that combination is a strong signal that the line has likely been crossed. It suggests the practice is probably driven by strategic self-interest rather than a commitment to scientific integrity that you'd want everyone to uphold.
It really forces a kind of self-reflection, doesn't it? Thinking about your work from the outside, from the community's perspective.
Exactly. It encourages you to use reason, consider counterarguments. The second question, especially, connects your actions to your self-concept as a researcher. Could this practice become a standard? Would that be good for the field?
And it's not just about individual reflection in a vacuum. The paper stresses the collective level, the community. This brings back strategic versus communicative action.
Right. Strategic action is goal-oriented, get published potentially regardless of community approval. Communicative action is oriented towards reaching understanding consensus through reasoned argument.
And QRPs like p-hacking often look like strategic action.
Yes, they become questionable when that strategic action prioritizes individual gain over the discipline's integrity. Communicative action acts as a check, ensuring our methods serve the common good of science.
So a practice that benefits one person at the expense of the community probably wouldn't survive open discourse.
That's the idea. It likely wouldn't achieve consensus if discussed openly and honestly.
The paper then mentions Habermas's principles for achieving this consensus. Mm. How do they apply here?
Well, Habermas suggests a norm is valid if everyone affected could jointly accept the consequences of its general observance without coercion.
Okay, everyone could agree to live with the results if everyone followed that rule.
Basically, yes. And moral norms need to be generalizable, acceptable to all concerned. So applying this, acceptable research practices should be things the whole community could rationally agree on and generalize across the field.
So violating established rules or using methods you wouldn't want generalized without that broader agreement, that's crossing the line.
That's the core logic. It provides a normative basis grounded in reason and potential consensus.
Can you give an example? The paper uses subset analysis to show how this framework helps.
Sure. So imagine a researcher collects data, finds no overall effect, but then notices an interesting pattern in, say, just the women over 40 in their sample.
Okay.
If they then report only that subgroup finding as if it were their main hypothesis, without acknowledging it was exploratory or post hoc, that looks questionable.
How does the framework help decide?
The researcher asks, would others worry I'm just cherry-picking a result here? Probably yes. And do I think analyzing subgroups this way, after the fact and without strong prior reason, should be standard practice? Probably no. That combination signals it's likely p-hacking, not just exploration.
But if they had a strong theory beforehand about that subgroup, or if they transparently reported it as an exploratory finding needing replication,
then the answers might be different. The context and transparency matter. The framework links individual actions to what's desirable for the community, grounding it in the researcher's rationality and potential harm to the field.
It respects freedom, but demands accountability to the community.
Precisely. Your freedom is limited by your capacity to justify your actions in a way that resonates with shared scientific values.
Looking beyond the individual researcher, the paper briefly touches on other players, editors, reviewers.
Yes, it emphasizes that creating an ethical culture isn't solely on researchers. Editors or reviewers play a huge role. They can champion transparency, demand better methods reporting, facilitate discourse. Journals themselves can foster reproducibility.
And there was also the point about maybe needing to reevaluate academic career structures.
Absolutely. Addressing the intense publication pressure, especially the publish or perish aspect, is seen as key to reducing the incentive for QRPs. Maybe find other ways to value researchers' contributions.
So it's a systemic issue requiring broad effort, not just individual choices, but the environment they operate in.
Exactly. And the authors suggest these discourse principles aren't just for quantitative studies. They could apply to qualitative research too, offering a starting point for a broader discussion across science about expected conduct.
This has been really illuminating. It's clear that drawing that line between acceptable and unacceptable research, it's genuinely complex.
It really is. There aren't always easy answers. But I think the key takeaway from the paper and our chat is that ethical research demands ongoing self-reflection
Yeah, thinking about your own practices.
and considering how they align with the broader goals and values of the scientific community. Moving beyond just strategic thinking, how do I get published, towards more communicative action, is this good, transparent, reliable science?
So for you listening, whether you're doing research or just consuming it, maybe keep those two questions in mind. Would others have justifiable concerns? And should this be the norm?
Thinking about those nuances helps us all contribute to, hopefully, a more trustworthy and robust scientific enterprise because we all rely on it.
Definitely. And maybe a final thought to leave everyone with. Thinking about this framework, how can we, individuals, institutions, funders, journals, maybe even the public, work together more effectively to build and maintain a stronger culture of ethical research? How do we collectively strengthen the reliability of the knowledge that shapes our world?